Does the Yoga Sutra from potentially have roots in Vedanta, particularly the yamas and the niyamas? I don't think I really have enough information to answer that. I can tell you a few things, though, that in the darshana system, which is, there are both, in the darshana system, they're both what we call astikas and nastikas. The astika darshanas are the ones that accept the Vedas as a pramana. And those darshanas include Sankhya and Yoga, on the Mimamsa, which is an analysis of the first part of the Vedas, the Karmakanda. And then the Uttara Mimamsa, the Vedanta, right? So there's the Vedanta, the Mimamsa, Sankhya, Yoga, and then the Nyayaikas, the logicians, and the Vaisheshikas. Vaisheshikas, another group. The Nyaya and Vaisheshikas are two darshanas that are related. The Sankhya and the Yoga are related. They're related in the sense that they're both separate and independent, but the Sankhyas felt or realized that the potential yoga really was kind of the necessary sadhana for recognizing, for understanding the truth of what the Sankhya teachings were revealing. But that truth could be understood having a direct, immediate recognition of what the Sankhyas were talking about through the practice of the Ashtanga Yoga of Patanjali, right? And so, and then the Patanjali Yoga people who were, I don't know if it was Patanjali himself, but the people who were practicing in the ancient days, the Patanjali Yoga, felt that the Sankhya was a good philosophical system for it, right? And so that its practice, you know, was supported by the Sankhya philosophical system. So they consider themselves more related to each other. On the other hand, the Advaita Vedanta uses the Patanjali Yoga, the Ashtanga Yoga, and feels very resonant with it, though what the Advaita Vedanta has to say is very, very different, in fact, from what the Sankhya Yoga has to say. It's very different, but in some ways it's the same. So let me just tell you quickly how it's the same, so you can see why the Patanjali Yoga Sutras will resonate with the Vedanta as well as with the Sankhya. And in fact, I think other darshanas will use it also. So these astika darshanas, there are six of them, they all accept the Vedas as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, for one thing. So they have to have some things in common. So just very briefly, the difference between the Sankhya system and the Advaita Vedanta is that Advaita Vedanta is non-dual, where there is one Brahman, one conscious being that we can also call the infinite Satchit Ananda Purusha. One conscious being that we call Brahman, the Purusha. And from that Brahman, this entire manifest creation, which is Mithya, comes into manifestation and sustained resolves from beginningless time. And so the truth of every jiva is that one non-dual Brahman, just like the truth of the whole creation is this one non-dual Brahman. That's the Advaita Vedanta. Now, when the Sankhya is Dvaita, it's completely dual. It looks where we say this creation is a manifestation of Maya, which is made of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. They say this creation is a manifestation of Prakriti, which is also only Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. But the difference between Maya and Prakriti is that Maya is Mithya. It has no independent being. Where in the Sankhya, the Prakriti is its absolute reality. It's dual in that it's composed of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. It projects the whole creation, and then the creation, just like in Vedanta, the creation is projected, sustained, and resolves in both. One is Mithya and depends upon Brahman for its being. In the Sankhya, the Prakriti is absolutely real. It's matter. It's what we call matter. Now this matter, which is beginningless, and also cyclic, the Kriya projects cyclically, like Advaita Vedanta, the Maya is beginningless and projects Srishti Stiti Laya, projection, sustenance, sustaining, resolving cyclically. But the Prakriti, exactly the same in that way, but it is real material and dual within itself, of course, just like this is dual within itself. And this dual prakriti, which is real matter, is totally to be totally differentiated from the purusha of each individual. So each jiva has its own purusha, its own atma. The purusha is just that it's like the atma, it's just pure conscious being, but each individual has its own purusha. So there are many purushas, many conscious beings, not just one, but each conscious being is in a sense identical with Brahman. It's just infinite, it's infinite non-dual consciousness, but everyone has their infinite non-dual consciousness. So that's philosophically quite weak, but that doesn't matter right now. What matters is to understand that whether you have your own purusha, that purusha is non-objectifiable, pure conscious being. Okay? So whether it's the one non-dual Brahman or you have your own purusha, there is going to be a relationship between the body-mind sense organs, which is mitya or prakriti real, and there needs to be a recognition of the nature of yourself as kind of a non-objectifiable satchitananda self. And so even though the repercussions that come from the prakriti philosophy, still in terms of yoga, the recognition of this quietening the body, being able to follow dharma, the yamas and niyamas, you know, which is there really in all of the different darshanas, the value system is there, very similar. As students at school, sometimes I'll line these up. The value system, the yoga, the Sankhya, the Advaita Vedanta, Buddhism, they're all very, very similar, even in terms of the value system and the practices for Antakarana Shuddhi. All very, very similar. So there's similarity in that way in the yamas and niyamas. And then the meditative techniques also that are used in the Sankhya Yoga are also used in Upasana. They're used by Advaita Vedanta. Swamiji will take the Yoga Sutras and teach them. He's taught them several times, actually. You know, especially at Salersburg. I don't know that he may have taught them in India also, but I know several times he's taught them in Salersburg, and he's done camps with Ramanand Patel, who's a Hatha Yogi, who's a very, very highly respected person, and also one of Swamiji's students. And so they've done they've done camps together where Swamiji would teach the Vedanta. And Ramanand Patel and the yoga, he'd teach the Vedanta and the Yoga Sutras, and Ramanand Patel would teach the pranayama and the asanas and, you know, that. So there's a lot of, even though the two systems are very different, there's also, you know, quite a bit of similarity in terms of the relationship between the purusha and the prakriti. In some ways it's so different, but I can see why we can use this, the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, in a way that is helpful for us, you know. But we would never kind of agree with the Sankhya philosophy, even though there are the similarities between the individual, what your individual purusha is satchit, pure conscious being. Brahman is satchit, pure conscious being. Right? And then that is the nature of yourself. Their idea of moksha and everything is different also. So. Anyway, that's just an aside to try to help give a little depth to my answer. So I don't think that it really has its roots in Vedanta, but I don't really know what it has its roots in. I don't know that it has its roots in Sankhya either. I don't know where the yoga comes from. I think it's very, very ancient. Very ancient, but I don't know its history. Do you? Sky? Do you know any stories or anything?
Hard to find any certainty.
Yeah.
They said somebody found some kind of scriptures or something in Mysore and then tried to put together something when there was some agriculture movement or whatever. It started bringing people who knew some things, mostly from rituals, postures from rituals, and then they kind of compiled
all the knowledge.
Yeah. Started to share a little bit, and then potentially put it all together.
Oh, I see.
System,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
So Patanjali was. It's unclear whether he was like a rishi revealing, or whether he was
Yes.
Yeah. He's truly taken as a sage, as a rishi, I think.
Yeah.
And revealing the knowledge.
Yoga is so special. Yeah, it's amazing. So, okay, so I can't answer any more than that. So as far as my knowledge goes. Okay. When we pray to a Shiva Lingam, are we praying to the subtle body? What is the difference between Ahankara and the subtle body? Does it travel with the subtle body? Okay. The first one, when we pray to the Shiva Linga, you know, I think some Indians view this in different ways because, say, that like the Dakshinamurti, the Murti of Dakshinamurti, like at the temple, for instance, the Jnaneshwari and the Shivalinga are all there. Ganesha is also there. Those murtis have been handled very traditionally. All of the rituals, all of the prayers, everything that is supposed to be done to invoke the deity has been done for those murtis. And so when we're contemplating and or praying in front of the murti, doing a puja to the murti, we say that that there's a presence in that murti that has been invoked through the pujas that are being done. So there's that aspect of it, that it's not just some stone there, that there's a lot of rituals and prayers and things and pujas and abhisheka that has been done to invoke the presence of the deity, the presence of Dakshinamurti, the presence of Shiva, Jnaneshwari, all of that. So I love that, and I also feel a certain sanctity when I'm at the temple. But also, when we're doing puja to the Dakshinamurti Murti, or just to the Shiva Linga, we are actually doing it to Shiva. So you can be doing it to, in your mind's eye, whatever form Shiva is in, or the Shiva can just be an aspect of Ishwara. You know, that part of Ishwara, the aspect of Ishwara that withdraws the creation, that removes Ajnanam, is Shiva. Whereas Vishnu is the one who sustains the creation, blesses you, you know. So you can invoke the deity, you can invoke Shiva or Krishna as Brahman, as the very self, or you can invoke them as Ishwara, or you can pray to that form, which is a form of Ishwara, you know, or you can have that Shraddha toward the Murti itself. But if you're having to the Murti itself, it's not toward a stone, it's toward the being that has been invoked, the subtle body, so to speak, that has been invoked in that murti, you know. And so in the end, whether it be of the form of Shiva or the form of Ishwara, Ishwara's form would, as a living entity, it'll have a subtle body, a physical body, that's Hiranyagarbha in Virat, you know, or Shiva also, or any deity, it's going to have a subtle form and a physical form, just like you do. Subtle form, the subtle is where the mind and that which reflects consciousness and all of that. So you can be praying to the deity, invoking Ishwara in that form, in the form of Shiva, or Ishwara in the form of Dakshinamurti, or of Jnaneshwari for the goddess. It's nice to be able to invoke, you know, Ishwara in the form of the Jnaneshwari, the goddess of knowledge too. They invoke the feminine, it's very beautiful. So you're invoking that being and praying to that being, not just to the form, but to the essence of that being. And in the end, the essence of that being is the Atma, is the self, which is yourself, which is Brahman. So. What is this next one? What is the difference between the Ahankara and the subtle body? Does it travel with the subtle body? Well, remember when we said the Antakarana, or the mind, it has four it has four categories of thought. One category was the chitta, just your memories. You can always, the memories are stored in the Ahankara, in the mind. That's chitta. Then the manas was the fluctuating mind, the indecisive mind, and also negative emotions are considered part of the manas, that category of thoughts. Then there's the buddhi. The buddhi is the determinative thinking, where there's clarity, where there's knowledge, those type of thoughts. And the other last one is the ahankara. The ahankara is the I notion. And so sometimes, as in the Drikdrisha Viveka, the ahankara is separated from the other three. because the other three are types of thoughts. Like you could have memories, or you could have fluctuating indecisive thoughts, or you could have, you know, not thoughts that are have clarity and are knowledge based type of thoughts. Here the ahankara is that thought that identifies my being, the me, with the thought, you know, or with the mind, or with the sense organs, or with the mood, or with the with my prana, you know, or with the condition of my body. So the ahankara is a different type of thought. It's always centered on me, and then identifying me because of self-ignorance with an upadhi, a conditioning adjunct that's reflecting me in some way. Like when the sukshma sharira is subtle body is indwelling the body, then this body enjoys consciousness, so I am the body, says the ahankara. So the ahankara, the I notion, is a product of self-ignorance, because the self is not the body or the mind or the sense organs, it's the non-dual conscious me being from which the whole creation comes. The whole creation is mithya, it doesn't bring about any change to myself, so I'm not any of these things, I'm the self of all of these things. It's very different. So the ahankara is born of ignorance, which identifies myself with anything that reflects consciousness, which would be the body, when the sukshma sharira, subtle body, is indwelling the body, you know, or the mind, which is sattva, or the sense organs, which are sattva. Now, when I'm talking like this, there's different ways of talking about it. I'm talking in the language of Driktrisha Viveka, because that's what's being taught. And they use their own way of talking about it, which I think is really interesting and fine. No problem. Does that answer the question? Oh, so what is the difference between the ahankara and the subtle body? The ahankara is just a type of thought that the subtle body has. Another way, more Driktrisha Viveka text way of answering that, is wherever there is sattva, like in the antakarana, in the mind, in the sense organs, in the sukshma sharira through the sense of touch pervading the physical body, wherever that sattva is there, where there's a reflection of consciousness, unless that is there is self-knowledge, that is taken to be me. Whether you say I or not, that I is a given in that situation. You might say, well, I am thinking, but what if you're just thinking? You still think you are thinking. So you don't have to have this word I. It's the very fact of this identification, which is really because of the sattva that reflects consciousness. So from the standpoint of that which is reflecting consciousness, even if it's indwelling the body, then your sense is that you are the body. You don't have to, as the ahankara, you don't have to walk around and say, I am the body, or I am my mind, or I am thinking, or I am sad. You just are that. Right? Where for a jnani, those experiences are all can all be there, but there's a viveka, differentiation between your own presence and the experiences that are coming and going. But that's not there for an ajnani. And so the ahankara, whether stated or not, is alive and well, as long as that ajnanam is there, as long as the sattva is there. So it's not identical with the sukshma sharira, but it is something that it's that manifest me wherever the sattva is, you know. And then if we want to talk about, well, what is that ahankara? It's the identification of myself with an upadhi. For that upadhi to be an upadhi, it has to reflect consciousness. A dead body is not an upadhi, you know. No, it's not. There can be a dead body there, and you can think, oh my God, you know, that person has died. You know, the person has died, as though the self, the conscious being, has died. But that's your own ajnana. It's not acting, functioning as an upadhi for you, and it's not functioning as an upadhi for the person who is left. The person who is left, you know. What is their experience going to be like? Say they're an ajnani. So I like to tell, I was just telling somebody the other day, what did Steve Jobs say when he died? He was just very weak and passing away, surrounded in he was in his bed at home, surrounded by his family. And so as he started to, you know, dying with that moment of just passing away, he goes like this, and he's lying down. He goes, wow! That's the best story. I love it. wow. Just think, you know. You think you're going to die, but you don't die. There's never even the slightest experience of death. It's just a change in the environment, of course. But there's no experience of death. Just like if you wake up from a dream, certainly a big change of environment, you know, right? But there's no death experience at all, zero. There never is, never has been, never will be. Because the self doesn't die. It's not an object within time and space to go through, you know, the process of aging or getting sick and dying like everything else in the creation does. Self is not an object in the creation to go through those kinds of changes. So does it travel? Does the ahankara travel with a subtle body? Definitely, because the ahankara, that ahankara is one of the natural vrittis that are there, and as the subtle body travels, the sattva of the subtle body travels, and so that reflection of consciousness or that sense of being me moves on. So when this body drops, me, the self, that is really a superimposition, travels on with the, because of the sattva, travels on to take the next body. But that sattva, that superimposition, is there because I am there. There's no place in the universe that doesn't have me for its adhishtana. So there's no escape. You can't go. It's nowhere in the universe you can go where I am not. Right? So this, wherever the sukshma sharira goes, as long as it's there, it will be reflecting me. Right? Because there is no universe apart from me. The whole universe is projected, sustains, and resolves into me. Just like saying, if you have an imagination, my imagination is leaking outside of myself. There's no such thing, you know. The imagination, you know, is three-dimensional as it is, as big or small as it is, can never be apart from your being. Right? You are the self of that imagination. You have no time and space. Time and space, that three-dimensional quality, is something that exists within the imagination, not within you. Right? So you should think about that when you have an imagination. It's three-dimensional, you know. It's kind of interesting. Oh, how many prakriyas are there and what are they, briefly? I don't know how many. I mean, there's like four or five that are very, very well known, and then modifications of those four ones. So there's Drik Drisha Viveka, the seer seen differentiation that we've been working with. There's another one I mentioned, the Avastatraya Sakshi, which is the witness of the waking, dream, and deep sleep state. That's a prakriya. There's the Panchakosha prakriya, the five sheaths. You know, with a little atma, you think the little atma is sitting like a little pea in a pod inside the body and the prana, and you go through the kosha by kosha by kosha, which is very similar to the Drik Drisha Viveka. Then there's what we call the Karyakarana Prakriya, the cause-effect, looking at the cause-effect relationship in this creation, and then looking at what that cause-effective relationship is in reference to consciousness is the material cause and this creation. So the cause-effect becomes one of satyam and mitya. The cause-effect relation resolves into satyam mitya, which takes quite a bit of teaching, but that is a very important prakriya. So I would say maybe the two most important prakriyas, of which everything else seems to be a modification of, is the seer-seen differentiation, Drik Drisha Viveka, and Karyakarana, the cause-effect. Prakriya. These are the two fundamental prakriyas. And then one, along with the Drik Drisha, comes the Avastatraya Sakshi, the one who's the witness of the waking, dream, and deep sleep, which is a very beautiful movement from the seer-seen differentiation in this world to going to the seer-seen differentiation between worlds, so to speak, the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, all of which totally worlds of experience that negate each other, recognizing that myself is free from those worlds. So those are the basic ones, and then there's modifications around those. So Swamiji wrote a nice book, little tiny booklet. It's called The Teaching of Advaita Vedanta. And in there he lists four or five prakriyas, a little paragraph on each one, which I think I just told you, the Panchakosha, Drik Drisha Viveka, Karyakarana, Avastatraya Sakshi, I think those are the ones, Karyakarma, those are the ones that he lists. But then we deal with we handle them in many, many different ways. So it's the same prakriya, but then you're kind of using different words, and so that your mind gets to see it just with these subtle nuances and things. Because if it didn't work in the first way it was taught, maybe it'll work in this way, and then in this way, and you start to really, really gain clarity around each one of them. When we study Vedanta and do puja, etc., are we Hindu? What does the word religion mean in relationship to Vedanta? There, long years ago, when I was at the first course in India in the 70s, it was the first course, Rambachan, Anantanand Rambachan, who has written a few texts, and he's a professor also in St. Olaf College, I think, in Minnesota. He's a really wonderful man, wonderful student. And the question came up in the satsang. We were in Bombay and Powai at that ashram there at that time. We were all sitting up there. And the question came up, what is the difference between a Hindu and, say, other religions? What differentiates Hinduism from other religions? That's a question, something like that. And so Rambachan, Anantanand Rambachan, has stood up and tell Swamiji what that is. And he said, for a Hindu, it's not that there is only one God, there is only God. And Swamiji loved that answer. There is only God. And so that is core to the Vedas. There's not one God, there's only God. And so then because of that, the God can be worshipped in infinite number of forms, actually. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, in whatever form you worship me, in that form I'll come to you. You know? And so in that sense, that Hinduism is kind of an all-encompassing religion, which has gotten them into trouble, actually. Because, say, another converting religion comes, and say you are a Christian and you believe in Christ, and Christ is your Ishta Devata. You know, so you can put Christ would be your, Krishna is my Ishta Devata, you know, the form of God that I feel most attached to, and yours is Christ. You know, and it is as the Muslims come, and your Ishta Devata is Muhammad. You know, we should put Muhammad onto our altar also. You know, so we are worshipping all of the different devatas, because everything just gets subsumed into the Hindu umbrella, because there is nothing that is not God, you know. So that's not quite answering your question, but I think it puts a nice backdrop to the question. So then we say, when we study Vedanta and do puja, etc., are we Hindu? I don't know. Do you call yourself Hindu or not? I mean, I love to chant, and I love the bhajans, and I do puja in my own way, and I study the... I have Shraddha in the Vedas. I have Shraddha in the Vedanta. You know, I feel totally at home in the culture. Does that make me a Hindu? Maybe. You know, the Hindus don't even think of themselves as Hindus. You know where the word Hindu came from? From people who could not, from foreigners coming into the country, who couldn't pronounce the word Sindhu. Sindhu means the Sindhu River. Those people that grew up along the Sindhu River, following the Sanatana Dharma, that beginningless Dharma, the flow of the Dharma that is really held in the Vedas and has been taught, you know, as an oral tradition from beginningless time. That's their view. And so if I say like that, then I said, yeah, that's what I am too. I'm part of that. But if we say Hindu, then we're categorizing ourself like, are you a Muslim, are you a Christian, are you a Buddhist, are you a Hindu, where do you... And then those terms just aren't enough for me. I feel that it's truth, that the it's a beginningless truth that's flowing, you know, to this day. To this day, it's alive and well, and we're within the flow of that tradition. And so I feel I'm within the flow of that Sanatana Dharma, that beginningless Dharma that is here still today after, you know, thousands and thousands of years. How many hundreds of thousands of years? I don't know. You know, and it's the promise of the Shastra, of the Vedas, that it will never not be here. Even if it's only little tiny pockets, those little tiny pockets will be here for the duration of the creation from beginning to end, for each cycle. It'll never, ever be lost. It's just that most people won't be interested, which is fine, because as long as the people that are interested, who have that mumukshutvam or that shraddha, that it is there for them, it will not, never be lost. So. In fact, sometimes I look at Swamiji, whose footprint was so huge over the whole world, actually. His mission later in life, in his 60s and 70s really, was really, after having taught all his life since he was a young man in his 20s, he's always taught and he's taught and given so many courses where the students would come and stay for 3-4 years sometimes, or even longer sometimes, just totally committed to gaining anicca and clarity in this knowledge. He taught so many, many people that he really strengthened the teaching methodology, the pramana, the traditional teaching of Advaita Vedanta throughout the world, not so much in the Western countries, but it's still here now in the Western countries. Instead of not being here at all, it is here, and it's pervasive throughout India. And then, having established that, he took up AIM for Seva, All India Movement, to kind of serve the tradition itself, to make strong the religious and spiritual traditions, the Dharma itself that holds the Vedanta. So he did so much work, even going into tribal areas and whatnot, to try to preserve them, whatever their beliefs, their culture was, to preserve them, to make sure that they were self-supporting, that they had a hospital, that they had water, clean water running, that they had proper septic systems, you know, and so that they could not convert to Islam or to Christianity, because that would cause them to lose their culture. If you become a Muslim, then you're a representative of the Muslim culture. You're no longer a Dharmi of this sacred culture. So he did so much work for 20, 25 years just in establishing and making stronger the Sanatana Dharma of India, you know. And so I kind of look at that as kind of Bhagawan. Bhagawan gave him that was his duty. In this birth, his upadhi had that duty to strengthen the tradition, the teaching tradition of the Upanishads, and then to create the protection, the cultural protection to protect that, you know, to establish and strengthen the culture itself, which he did. He did that. He was so committed to it. But it had such a huge footprint that you can't, and he would never say, I did it. He said, this is Ishwara. This is such a huge undertaking. No person is doing this. This is Ishwara himself living up to his promise that this culture, this Sanatana Dharma, will never ever perish, and this teaching tradition will never perish as long as the creation is here. I have shraddha in that. I can't imagine what would this world be without it. Ooh, it's very painful to think about it. So.
Very, very many confused jivas wandering around.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter as long as they can become unconfused and get knowledge. Yeah. What if they're just confused? We're all confused people walking around, but there's no way to get unconfused. That's the promise that will never happen.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, if it wasn't for Swamiji, there would be a lot of confused jivas wandering around.
That's true. Yeah. He was a huge, he had a huge mission. It's all Ishwar. It is said that Dharma always wins in the end. Please expand on that. I can see what that could mean in terms of my own life, that following Dharma is the only way I can gain moksha. But I think the expression is in relationship to the world, that it doesn't seem that Dharma will win before Pralaya. Please help straighten this out. Well, I think the idea there is that Dharma actually is the nature of reality. Reality means the Vyavahara, Ishwara's creation. The bones of Ishwara's creation is Dharma, right? And so the adharma will always, you know, can cause so much pain and misery. There's no question about that. It causes pain and misery. But it cannot stand the test of time because it itself has no legs to stand on. Adharma itself is not supported by the creation. So I'll tell you what our problem is with it, for all of us, is that a human life is short. And so Dharma, in terms of your human experience, depending on when you're born, can seem to outlast the cultural Dharma, the Dharma of the world, you know, can seem to be overwhelmed by a Dharma for your lifetime. And so it's not as though you get to see some sort of a renaissance or a revival of Dharma, even though what the Shastra says is once that imbalance becomes so much between Dharma and Adharma, it's in Bhagavad Gita, once the imbalance becomes so much that the Dharmis have not a prayer, they can't survive because the Adharma, those who are carrying the carriers of Adharma are so powerful that there's no place for the Dharmis. At that time, then Bhagawan will bring an avatar, bring some sort of a force to bring that back into balance. So there's that extreme, you know, that when things are so bad that the Dharmis don't have a chance to survive, at that time Bhagawan will take a form. And so it's kind of, if you think about it, it's kind of like, if you have a dream, you know, and in the dream there are all these monsters coming to eat you, right? And they're all huge and you don't have a prayer, right? And so at that time, say the ones who are going to be eaten by all the monsters call out to you, the dreamer, save us, please, help us. Come and get us, save us, do something. And you hear the prayer, right? Because you're the dreamer, you're the Ishwara of the dream. And so you go in, you know, and with a big hand, you just pull them out and put them in another location, and those monsters can't get you then. What I'm saying, you know, that's silly, but what I'm saying is that you, in your reference to your dream, you can enter the dream and affect the dream because it's your dream. Especially in a lucid dream, people experience this all the time. So say you're having like an active imagination in Jungian terms. And so in that active imagination, you're kind of deep in the world of the psyche and all kinds of things are helping, are going on. And you, the buddhi, just like when we do inner child work, you can enter in and influence what is going on there. We do that in psychology often. It's called active imagination. So think of the whole creation as your infinite mind, and the whole thing is becoming topsy-turvy in some ways, being overwhelmed by a dharma. Then the creation as a conscious being can take action, whatever that is, in reference to all of the laws, instead of anthropomorphizing it, just think in reference to all of the laws, appropriate things taking place to set it back in balance. So I look at it like that. And also, even there are different names of the Lord. One is Janardana. Janardana means the one who punishes the adharmis. Because adharma, when you commit an adharma, you immediately suffer from that adharma. A lot of pain, a lot of isolation, a lot of discomfort, you know, not being one with yourself, you know. And on the other hand, they say, so adharma creates a lot of pain and suffering, but dharma protects you. And so you also feel that way when when your behavior and your treatment of others and your values, you know, are you uphold those with commitment and respect and shraddha, that dharma also protects you. So it also says in the shastra, dharma protects, because every possibility is here in the creation, you know. And so you want to stay always in terms of your behavior, you want to stay on the side of dharma, because you feel protected by that dharma. And you feel the opposite when there's some adharma going on. Any little adharma that we do, we learn quickly, because it's such a isolating experience. So this dharma always wins in the end. I think you have to look at it as dharma is really the law, you know, and adharma is butting up against the laws of dharma. And so it's the laws of dharma that will win. There aren't any laws of adharma. Right? The adharma is always butting up against the laws of dharma, which I would say kind of squash it. Squash and kill and hurt destroy the adharma. So the adharma, but the adharma can last for some long time from our perspective as a human being. We often, it seems to me, talk about tamasic qualities as less worth than sattvic. Please talk about that. Well, you use the word sattvic, tamasic, rajasic here, adjectival. So when we're using, if we're using sattva, rajas, and tamas as the three strands of the creation, it's not, all three are absolutely necessary for the expression of this creation, because you need to have nama rupa, you need name and form, you need tejas, you need energy, you know, and you need consciousness. So all of these three woven together in terms of the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, with their aspects of sattva, rajas, and tamas, is what is the material cause of the creation. So there, it's not this is better than that. It's a totally irrelevant and a meaningless kind of categorization that doesn't apply. But now, say, we're using it adjectivally. Is sattva, rajas, a sattvic mind, a rajasic mind, a tamasic mind? You should read in the Bhagavad Gita chapter 14, 15, 16, and 17, where they do a whole analysis of what is sattvic food, what is rajasic food, what is tamasic food. The sattvic food goes into helping your system have shanti or balance or well-being. Rajasic food creates agitation. Tamasic food makes you go to sleep, right? Then they talk about it even in terms of sleep, how much sleep. You should not sleep too much, but not too little either. The body needs to get just the amount of sleep that it needs so that it can wake up and be fresh. But if you sleep all day long, you become very tamasic and you don't even want to get up. You know, so it talks about all of these types of things. You know, it talks also in terms of your mind, in terms of your values. A sattvic mind is a mind that reflects ananda, fullness, happiness, a sense of well-being. So we want a sattvic mind. We want to just always be walking around in a sattvic mind. What can give you that sattvic mind, other than knowledge, is just dharma. Staying within dharma assures a sattvic mind. Yeah. A rajasic mind is an agitated mind. A tamasic mind is a dull, slothful mind. You know, this dull, slothful body or agitated, angry type of thing is rajas. And so in that case, there is a preference, you know. So we could say, like, a pundit or a sadhu or a spiritual person, a priest, an educator, is primarily sattva. They have more predominantly sattva. A warrior, an administrator, the president, a government official, they are predominantly, or a king, or a prince, or a queen, these type of people, they are predominantly rajas, with sattva as their secondary category, and then as their secondary quality. So such a person has the energy to rule and to lead, and the power to do that, but because of the sattva, they all also have a good value system. They say a vaish, that would be Brahmana Kshatriya is the Kshatriya. Then the Vaishya would be like the business person or the person in agriculture. They say that person is primarily Rajas with Tamas as the secondary quality. So it's not that they're necessarily working off of their value system. They want to be successful. They want to make money. They want to, you know, they're competitive. They want to excel like that in terms of their business and power and money. That would be Vaishya. And then there's the Shudras. The Shudras are maybe predominantly Tamas with Rajas. And what the Shudras do are the people who really help and serve and take care of the people who are, you know, running a business, for instance, or running the government, or, you know, they're the people who are serving the people who have more positions of power and authority. Those are called the Shudras. They don't themselves really need or want to have to be leaders or to have any particular power. They want to have their 8 to 5 and do their job, you know, do their job and be able to go home and be with their family. You know, so that's, I'm just telling you, not that these categories are alive and well today, because there's so much mixing, but a Shudra can be the king, and you know, a Brahmana can be, you know, servant. It's all mixed up now. But just to kind of understand this kind of differentiation using sattva, rajas, and tamas, that's why I'm telling you this. Not that this is holding so firm these days. It's not. But the idea is, I think we have all of these categories of people. We don't label them, that's all. But we all know very well these categories. It's not like these categories don't exist. They do. You know. But in India, At one time, they were very dominant in the culture. Now, those categories. You were born into being a Brahmana or Kshatriya, etc. You were actually born into that. And then usually took on the job of your father. So it's just a very different type of culture than we have in the West. And it's very different in India now also, though the remnants of all of that, the samskaras of it all, are still very much there. Good. That's all. Mm-hmm. We've got 5 minutes, we could have a nice budget. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Malika? Oh, please. One or two or whatever you feel to do. Mm.
Thank you. I think this is the one Felicia asked for. So, you? Was
yeah,
it you?
Found them on.
Uh-huh. Oh, I thought, okay. I think it's this one.
Please.
Jai Sitaram, Jai Hanuman. Jai Sitaram, Jai Hanuman. Jai Sitaram, Jai Hanuman.
Any requests? Any requests?
I don't know the names. I like all the ones you do.
Anyone?
Om Namo Bhagavate.
I can't remember the chords. Sorry.
Do you know any of Swamiji's compositions?
I don't actually. I need to learn.
What one you like? What are your favorite ones?
Okay.
Bye.
Gayatri mantra.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, no, not only. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah.
Rama Nama Tarakam Sada Bhajore
Sada Bhajore
Sada Bhajore
Sada Japore
Sada Japore
Rama Nama Tarakam
Rama Nama Tarakam
Sada Bhajore
Sada Bhajore
Rama 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 Jaya
Rama 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 Jaya
Kodandarama
Kodandarama Rama 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 Jaya
Kalyana Rama
Kalyana Rama
Rama Rama Rama Jaya
Rama 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 Jaya
Shringara Rama
Shringara Rama
Patabhirama
Rama Nama Tarakam
Sada Bhajore
Sada Bhajore Sada Japore
Rama Nama Tarakam
Rama Nama Tarakam
Sada Bhajore
Sada Bhajore
Prajapalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha O Brahmanebhya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Parahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhaya Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramaya Sarve patrani pasyantu ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma satgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om